for burying her was $200, paid for from welfare funds. The death certificate said she died of hepatitis, but that's only part of the story. Gloria Curtis was a Chippewa Indian. And like thousands of other Indians, she began to die the moment she left the reservation to come to the city. In the next half hour, we'll look at the reasons why. I'm Bill Moyers. Urban areas. Here in Minneapolis, for example, Indians have quadrupled in number in the last decade to an estimated 10 or 12,000. They came here from the reservation searching for a better life. They found instead a society that launched the white man's stereotypes of the Indian while treating the Indian himself with disregard or contempt. The plight of urban Indians, whether in Minneapolis, Los Angeles, or New York, is the plight of aliens in a foreign land. Of people so unaccustomed to city ways that coping with a supermarket or even using a telephone become obstacles to survival. And those are merely superficial hurdles. The Indians speak of deeper wounds, of landlords who won't rent to them even when there are vacancy signs, of employers who will not hire them even when there are jobs to fill, of credit that is suddenly unavailable if an Indian applies. In frustration, many Indians move back and forth to the reservations. As nomads in a strange new world, more likely to be unemployed, to suffer more illness, to die younger, and to get a poorer education than any other ethnic group. It was to look at the circumstances of Indians surrounded by white men, of ancient traditions caught in a tangle of city ways, that we came to Minneapolis. And it was here that we stumbled accidentally upon the story of Gloria Curtis. All the facts about her were hard to come by. But we learned enough about the last weeks of her life to believe that what happened to her is not unusual, is indeed part of a continuing tragedy of misunderstanding that runs from wounded knee to wounded knee. There was no obituary for Gloria Curtis when she died, no record of her life except in the memory of a handful of people. They told us that she had been born in 1945 on the Red Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. That she had come to Minneapolis as a young teenager with her parents, who were looking for that elusive new life. At 17, she married, and for the next few years, she and her husband, an unskilled laborer, moved back and forth between Minneapolis and the small towns where he could find work. Last summer, they were separated. Gloria took custody of the 5 children and applied for welfare. She contracted hepatitis sometime in the fall. Bitter experiences in the hospital, word that the power company had turned off the lights in her apartment, caused her summarily to go home.
I was there to help her as an Indian.
These Indian community workers came to know Gloria during the final few weeks of her life.
With the social workers against her, you know, because I got the idea that she didn't trust them. They didn't ever talk nice to her. They just sort of bawled her out every time they talked to her. And she said that there was only 2 of them that were really good to her. The rest acted like they held her in contempt, or they didn't. She said they don't even really want to take care of me. Like they don't want to touch me, like I'm poison or something.
What were the things that were on her mind when you talked to her that were troubling her?
Mostly was her worrying about her kids.
She was worried about her children getting to school. She was having trouble with them. I don't know, something was going on at school there. And she had her kids in the day of work. And so she was depressed when I seen her then.
And the fact that, you know, that she wasn't home taking care of them. And that sort of that there was no way to call home and see how they were all the time. They didn't have a phone in their apartment.
Were the children getting enough to eat and getting clothes and getting taken care of?
Well, really, when you're on AFTC, you get enough to pay $50 a month for clothes, and during the winter, you don't get any extra for winter clothing and boots. You just have to make do with what you get.
And especially in the apartment they lived in, she said everything was wrong with it. I mean, the plumbing was real bad. And
Ruth had told me it was condemned once in 1969. Oh, we went to see the caretaker. We said, oh, wasn't this building condemned? She said, oh yeah, it gets condemned every once in a while, but the owner has it sprayed for cockroaches every 6 months. But she says he sprays one unit at a time, and they just move next door, and then they spray another unit, and they move next door, so they end up coming back here all the time.
Well, she wanted to get a different house. That was the first thing, you know, because she told me that when the water would drip into the kitchen from upstairs, and it probably was from their bath, for their sake.
She only could rent it to Indians and hippies.
This was the caretaker?
Yes.
And she said that every time she tried to look for a different place to move, she said she'd call up and the people would talk real nice to her on the phone and tap and tell her to come out and look at an apartment. She said, but when she'd get out to look at it, they'd say it was rented. So she sort of felt that people just didn't want to rent to Indians, and it was hard to find a place with, you know, five kids anyway. She had lived in this apartment for 4 months, and she never received a light bill. And she had called the light company twice and asked them to send her a bill. And she said they never sent a bill. Then all of a sudden they shut off electricity without notifying them or anything.
She called me back here at the office to find out if I had gotten the lights turned back on. And I told her, no, I hadn't, not yet. And I called down to the light company and tried to make some arrangements. I said, well, she's really sick and she's in the hospital and the kids are at home, you know. He says, well, everybody has their problems. She has to have money. And so I got a hold of her worker down at the welfare department, and she said, well, I don't have her case anymore. Someone else has it, so she gave me her name. I got a hold of that worker, and she said that she would call the light company and have the lights turned back on, but that the money would have to be deducted from her check at the beginning of the next month, and that was the only way they could do it. So I called Gloria back and told her this, and she said, all right, just as long as they get the lights turned on.
And she said, I find myself all that plus the way they were treating me there. She said that they were really treating me horrible.
She said, one morning I asked one of the nurses for a roll of toilet tissue. She said, they brought it to me that night.
She said, when I was leaving, one nurse called at her and told her, we didn't ever want you in. We didn't want you in the hospital anyway. When we hoped you didn't come back. Now I hope you never come back here again.
They didn't treat you right on that.
This is Gloria's husband, Fred.
Oh, you know. A lot of stuff. They didn't want to go back to him. She could have went down on in general. There's a chair right there. Smoke, you know, because when the cigars are, door open, smell all that stuff in there. She closed the door, and the nurse comes and opens it again. She said, leave the door open. She didn't tell me.
She won't tell me.
I know she was sick too, you know.
Yeah. Did she ever mention that she might die or something?
And she always said that, yeah.
What did she say?
She said, I wish I was dead, she said,
yeah.
Yeah.
Gloria's condition worsened, and 2 days later, refusing to go back to the same hospital, she was admitted to a second institution.
When we went in, the admitting clerk, I told her that she was supposed to be admitted and that she had infectious hepatitis. She says, well, she isn't supposed to be here. She's got infectious hepatitis. So, well, she has to be admitted to the hospital. She's never been here before. Her doctor was supposed to call and make the arrangements. And she checked the files and stuff, and she said, well, he hasn't called and he hasn't made any arrangements, so I don't know what to do. And she called another girl in, and they discussed, you know, what they were going to do. And she said, well, I have to go to lunch. I can't take care of this right now, and there isn't anyone else to take care of it, so you'll have to wait. I said, no, we're not going to wait. You know, she has to be admitted now. And the admitting clerk was really mad because I guess we were the fridge for lunch hour.
How did she seem to you, Gloria?
When I went to the caretaker's apartment, I couldn't get a good look at, you know, her coloring and everything. And when she was sitting there, her body was so full of infectious hepatitis, her coloring was just awful. And she was like, she was just limp, you know, like all her energy had been drained out. She was really, really sick. She was having pains in the, you know, back. And then when I had seen her, I knew that she, you know, she was real sick because she is, her face was all swollen since the last time I had seen her, really bad. 2 days after she went back to the hospital, she went into a coma and died. She died 2-3 days after that, I think.
2 days before Christmas?
Yeah.
Charlie Deegan directs the Indian Health Board, a job that keeps him in touch with the Indian community. As we walk through the Indian ghetto of Minneapolis, I talk with him about Gloria Curtis.
Do you think that what happened to Gloria is an isolated case, or is it representative of what happened to all?
Well, I think it's quite representative of a lot of the turmoil that we go through and the adjustment as we move to the city. And what I call, a lot of us come under a culture shock. The adjusting across this bridge from one lifestyle to the other, from one lifestyle where human relations mean so much to another lifestyle where the dollar is master. In a city, you know, Bill, we crises live. There's an absence of planning because all you have is today and today's food and today's earnings. And you don't have anything for tomorrow. So we live from one crisis to the other. And either a crisis with school, truancy with the children, someone's late, inadequate clothing, not enough food because you're paying too much for the little food you have now and the short dollars that you have. And so it's just a constant, endless crisis. And this causes mental strain in the marriage. A lot of the marriages break up because not enough money and those kinds of things.
Well, why did the Indians come?
Well, I guess it's like up on the reservation, some of the housing was so bad. And up there, we have like a 90% unemployment figure many times on the reservation. 60% is normal. You hear older people say, well, it was rough in the Depression. I came through the Depression. And the Depression was glorious times for us, comparatively speaking, on the reservation. If we had that high unemployment on the reservation, it would be an all-time high economic.
There is plenty of evidence to back up what Charlie Deegan told us, proof that the attitudes and frustrations that bedeviled Gloria Curtis and finally broke her spirit are a fact of life among urban Indians. There is the testimony, for example, of some of Charlie Deegan's friends. Ever since they left the White Bird Reservation 10 years ago, they've been trying to make a go of it, first in Cleveland, then Detroit, Chicago, and now Minneapolis. It's been a rough trip, plagued by health and financial problems, by drinking, and by prejudice. A story not unlike that of Gloria Curtis, but in the case of Don and Lucille Goodwin, a story with a happier ending.
I started working at Ford Motor Company, and things went pretty good there for a couple of years, maybe 2 years and a half. I met new friends. I started drinking pretty heavy. And I thought it was part of living. Working until the weekend came up and going out on the weekend and drink. And this is, I've seen it all my life, this is what they did. So I thought this is what I had to do. And so this is the same thing what I did, but it caught up with me. I couldn't handle it as good as the other people, because I don't know why it was. Maybe it was, they was, they didn't have to put up with this thing that I had to put up in a city. I mean, this was back on reservation, but I seen it. The reason I was fired was for this reason. I was, went out for lunch, and came back, approached this guy that was always calling me Chief or Indian Hayes, you know. chief or something like that. But I would try to laugh it off and see how I got a few under my belt, and I would have more courage. And I started fighting with him. And he didn't tolerate that, definitely. They fired me.
Did you walk up to him and call to let him have it?
Yeah, that's right. I would approach him until I had more courage.
Have you encountered prejudice in Minneapolis?
Maybe anybody, but like our neighbors were always staring, you know, and the one guy down the street told the kids to go back to the reservation when they belong. And I've noticed with this one neighbor of ours, any other kids can go into his yard, but the minute my kids go near him, he really throws big fits. And I guess they were brought up to hate Indians. So many times I just, you know, really feel like going out there or, you know, getting them out of here. But I feel we're just as, you know, just as good as they are.
In my job, I see this quite often in the courthouse in Minneapolis.
After Don Goodman completed the Alcoholics Anonymous program, he got a job as a counselor at the Indian Neighborhood Club. He helps other alcoholics, including those in trouble with the law.
This Indian fellow came up to court, and he was for assault and breach of peace, and he was bailed. His bail was $100. So he didn't have the $100, so they put him back into the bullpen.
I can't afford to pay that fine.
Did you have nobody represent you?
No.
Other organization?
No.
Nobody.
I wanted to help out myself.
And a couple of cases later, a white guy came up for the same charges. And his bail was $100, but he got set free to get his $100, to raise his $100. For the Indian couldn't do it, he had to go back and sit back in the bullpen until somebody came up with the $100, so he had to sit there until the court came.
What do you remember about looking for a place to live in the cities?
I would always go look for the houses, because on several occasions, you know, Don, if we never got any results, I guess Don would be with me. And so I would go get the house. And then on several occasions where they saw Don, they changed their mind. Something came up where they couldn't rent to us, and or we just, you know, could feel it, that it was just prejudice.
When we was looking for a house, we was thinking on moving out of the city, out in the suburbs someplace, but I told my wife that this is the first year that my kids ever went to a school, a whole year at one school. And I said, if we move out of Minneapolis into the suburbs, or just out even into another area, it would be like moving into another city for them. They'd have to adjust and make new friends all over again.
No, I think we're really on our way to, at least we try, we're living for our kids and trying to set an example for our children.
Gloria Curtis found herself trapped between an old culture slowly being exterminated and a modern way of life she could not comprehend or conquer. The Goodwins almost perished in that same no man's land. Now they want their children to learn to live in two different societies, one white, the other Indian. In this special Indian survival school in Minneapolis, which for lack of money has had to struggle to stay open, these children are taught that because they are Indian, they're not second-class citizens. They're taught to cope with the new civilization, and yet to be proud of their own identity, of their Indian ancestry. It was a chance Gloria Curtis never got.
One day you'll get up and look around you, seeing all the strange and scary things, and realizing suddenly all this happened while I slept. Looking toward the forest green, now nothing stood but smoke so black and foggy. Children crying, screaming, running. One little girl, black and blue, eyes all swollen and oh so still. Lying there, I picked her up and brought her in, praying to God to let her through. Don Gordon is gone.
Do you remember that we had a thing one day where we were writing about the differences between living in the city and living on the reservation?
A dirty top layer full of crust and frog. The frog ate, topped
of crumpy, slimy logs flowing above. It smells like pollution, like something spoiled or old for a long time.
Thank you, Ralph. We knew what you were talking about, but you didn't have to use the exact words to let us know that. You know what I mean? You could describe it by comparing it to something else. And that's when you start getting into good things. You don't have to be really literal about everything. What are the kind of things you do? Would you rather live up in Panema than down here?
It's hard to see.
What do you think are some of the differences?
Oh, there's convergence. Anywhere you can live, you can pack.
There's what?
Anything you can pack, do anything you want.
There's about, I don't know, there's a lot of houses around one place, and then out through there's a little blue house where the grounds live, and they have horses, and usually the horses, you know, get away. So I'm trying to leave my dad's garden.
What else do you do?
Well, we know more people up there than we do down here, so it's a lot harder.
Over here, I don't know, you feel more better when you know more people.
Harder, they can see. Like back home, where we're from and stuff, we get to be free. And in the cities, there's not very many places to go. But except Indians.
Oh, and the reservation.
Gloria Curtis was never to find her place, on either the reservation or in the city. This is why her life and her death represent the tragedy of Indians who live in urban America. She never learned the skills to beat the city, although at the end, she was trying. Her death certificate listed her occupation as retired nurse's aide, and early retired it was, at 27. We located the nursing home where she worked for a few months last spring.
I had one experience where Gloria helped me immensely. We had a 90-plus Indian lady in here. Someone said she was closer to 100. And she used to stuff paper wads down inside her stockings, and the girls kept taking them away from her. The poor little thing was just going insane, you know, taking away her belongings. And Gloria came and told me that's the way the old Indian women carried their money. So we left the little lady alone and left her keep the paper and wads in her stockings. They had no more trouble with her. She was interested in learning. She was a quick learner. And she helped me, not alone the patients, but she helped me to understand them. I can't remember the word for hungry. I should, because I heard it often enough, and I didn't know what that woman was saying. And Gloria came and told me she's hungry. That's what they say when they're hungry. And after that, when this little woman would scream that word, we'd go and get her a few crackers and a glass of milk. And we called her Skinny Dip. Her name was Skinaway. And we nicknamed her Skinny Dip, and she used to laugh when they'd call her that. Gloria was a big help for the Indian patients.
Did you ever talk to Gloria about the city or living on the reservation?
I said to her, I don't know what you Indians want to move into this asphalt jungle for. If I could just find a place to live like you could live up north, I'd go up there and stay there. She said, that is no heaven. Gloria told me one time that they weren't free up there. They didn't have the food that they wanted, they didn't have the clothes they wanted, and they had to take somebody else's leftovers, and they wanted to have better than that.
All of us think we'd make it, or we wouldn't come here. And none of us come here with that hopelessness or that helplessness or that despair. It's developed, see, and I suppose she still felt she was going to make it some way. I know I talked to my wife. We lived like this style for 15 years, and I was asked my wife, well, why did you stay with me? Why did you keep on? And she said, well, I felt you would straighten out really easy, and that things would get better and that we would make it. So even though you live in that, shall we say, today's hopelessness, the hope of the future, in a sense, where it keeps you going, that you're hoping for a chance to hope. You know, I don't think it was so much the hepatitis that killed her. My feeling, what killed her, is the bad attitude of that hospital, number one. The unwillingness of the hospital to admit they're deficient in dealing in cross-cultural areas. in the, just the general, I guess if, in some areas they call it just plain racism, is what killed her. She was a victim of racism.
Someone put a small bouquet on Gloria's grave. This is all that's left of it. When spring comes, and summer, this too will be gone. And Gloria will be just another forgotten Indian. Like her ancestors, a victim of progress and civilization. They perished in the early days from the white man's deliberate brutality, and later from his venal or stupid manipulation. Today they're simply ignored to death. I know warriors. Been out there and had seen the clinic and had really gone around and had checked out the living situation, the streams, and he was terribly concerned. Thought that there would be just a disaster if things didn't get really improved and cleaned up. He was very concerned about just the overcrowding and just the fact that the steers would be slaughtered and then parts of the steer were left around and not buried, and a lot of things like that seemed to be potential health hazard. I think, however, even Sunday when we went out, we were seeing some cleanup going on. I think there must have been.
They started building the latrines.
Right. They were digging latrines. They were cleaning up the trading post. I think a lot of those things were attended to. And out of that situation, came, I think, a better organized thing. You just can't imagine the immensity of organizing that in that situation. With so little, I think we would all be. Find it very difficult to function.
About how many people would you say were in the enclave there?
Well, I think at least that. It's pretty hard to give a good estimate of that.
I'd say there's several hundred people who were not residents before, and maybe 100.
And most of them were owned. They came in from other parts of South Dakota and Nebraska.
Oh, yeah,
all over,
yeah.
Canada as well.
Oh.
Means in control of the people there, and she left to it.
Well, I think leadership was shared. Russell Means was certainly one of the people. When we arrived at the trading post Saturday night, Dennis Banks was speaking. He's another very, very energetic and articulate leader. I guess his name Bellacourt? I don't think was there for at least part of the week. I read something in the paper that he was in Los Angeles. I think he was traveling and interpreting and doing some other things. Another young fellow, Carter Camp?
Stan,
who was in charge of security. I don't remember his last name. But it was a good, I sensed some pretty good cooperation among leadership, and things were shared, and very able.
Thank you, John. who's John?
John is a Methodist, and he works out of Washington. James Laird knows him. He is someone that, during times of crunch, as he calls them, the National Council of Churches calls upon him to work in this type of situation. He's been working closely, for instance, with Kent State, and very closely. In fact, he's involved in a lawsuit with the families of slain students against the government. He has a group working in Cairo, Illinois, a very difficult racial trouble spot. He worked with observers, the two Republican and Democratic conventions in Miami this year, with Observer Corps. He's had, what, 6-7 years of this type of work, and he's a very effective person. He works very, very well.
What is the situation of negotiation?
What's your reading, Bidge? I feel completely out of touch.
Nothing in the paper today. I talked out there yesterday or the day before. The Indians have asked that Nixon or the emissary from him meet directly with them. A lot of what they say basically is based on the Treaty of 1868, which recognized the Lakota tribes, I think, Abdallah are one of 7 tribes in the area as an independent nation, or as a nation with a certain relationship to the United States. And, you know, following that treaty, practical or not, you know, the relationship would come at a head of state level. And I think that's the basis of their point of view. I don't know what they're going to offer. I do know that the last offer the government made was a sealed offer, and there may have been points in it which have not been made public that they may include in the counter. I don't really know. It doesn't look like a fight right now.
Yeah. The last I heard was that the Indians had called for and was apparently going to take place a new election of the tribal. has that been shot down, or is that still current?
I think that will go ahead.
I think it has to, by their existing regulations. They have enough signatures, and assuming they don't rule them all invalid or something.
How does the AIM group feel about elections in general? They don't follow Indian tradition.
Well, this called for a referendum on the Constitution about the tribal council, which would be consistent with the AIM position.
Well, this AIM man who called me from Washington the day before yesterday said Bellicourt was making a very fast trip to Los Angeles, California, he said, now, in the hope of getting some of this under control. I don't know how many others will be looking at that.
I think that one, just thinking a little bit about what people such as ourselves can be doing at this point, seems to me that's one area that we've got to be focusing on is just increased pressure on Washington, meaning Justice Department, Interior Department. Certainly to say no more force, just to renounce the use of force in the situation and to cool it, and to really press for just in the most full public search of some of these issues, congressional hearings, as soon as possible. I think these things would be, just like you mentioned, very instrumental. We had the feeling from when we arrived, from Bernard and John Adams and others who had been there the previous week during the real crisis, that if there was anything that helped during that time, it was the pressure on Washington that Thursday.
Yes, well, of course,
which
we all
many of us, I think, were involved here. Yes.
Well, of course, they closed the White House line on us.
Keep
ringing it.
Sure.
But when we called, for instance, we're Jersey, so we called Case and Williams and so on, and some other friends called their congressmen. And they all claimed, their offices claimed, and they claimed when we talked directly with them, that they were working on it then. Now, whether you can have to go back at them to keep this up, I expect you do.
I think it's got to continue. I think there needs to be a continued focus. I guess what sort of comes through to me is that the actions of this type kind of create room for others to move. And there is more room to move, and I think we've got to find ways to... I understand FCNL has played quite a helpful role in contacting congressional people. But you got to keep it up, and I think the more we can do... that Thursday, Friends of the Urban Project office became just a communication line to Washington. One of our staff is an American Indian, Francis Spicer. And Francis and others who came in were encouraged to call. We had just had a series of numbers, called Schweiker, called Scott, called Justice Department. And it got to the point by about, I finally got a chance to call about 4. And when I reached Schweiker's office, they said, just a moment, we'll put you in touch with the Indian desk. They had a desk, and they were dealing with the whole question. And I think, if anything, averted that disaster, and I think a number of things contributed. People there felt that played a very major part. I kind of agree with Bitch's analysis. I say it with just, you know, real reservation, pardon the expression. Yeah.
Real reservation.
Yeah, hesitation, let's say.
Okay.
I don't think there's going to be a military move on the thing. I just don't think they could do it, and yet I still know enough about our government to expect the worst. And I think the more pressure we can put on, and that means continuing calls, wires, I guess even letters at this point would be helpful. And the whole question of hearings, let's have it open, let's have it really full, extensive. Let's get people like Russell Means and others to Washington to testify. That's what's going to begin to deal with some of the roots of these problems.
Will there be some hearings?
Yeah.
Scheduled or?
Yeah, I think it's...
Are they scheduled?
No, I don't know if they are. But I think it's a key thing. The other thing, of course, is continuing need for relief, and I think money is good.
And should it go to Denver, to this bank in Denver?
I have another address in Pine Ridge, which might be more direct.
It'd be closer.
Through
Bonifers.
Yeah.
There, it's the address I have is the Pine Ridge Relief Fund. Care of Father George Pierce, P-I-E-R-C-E, President.
Father George.
George Pierce, President.
P-I-E-R-C-E?
Yes. He happens to be the minister of the church where we stayed, Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
That's
sufficient?
Would it be the church
George
or
Pierce?
A box number?
No, there is a box number. I don't have it, but I'm
that's
sure
sufficient.
That's enough. They know about it.
You can send a letter to the Bishop of Pine Ridge at that address. Did you hear about that?
No.
Someone sent John a letter bomb.
A what? A letter bomb?
Yeah.
Oh,
unfortunately,
no.
It didn't go off.
Ooh.
That's
a lot of crazy stuff that's happening.
Well, another thing we can do is sort of straighten out local editors when they put one long the editorials in, and I have a copy of my little thing to the Doylestown paper, which put in a thing saying, the Indians are very wrong to take recourse to violent methods, and they should talk to us as one American to another. And I ended my letter. So looking at history, who gets results? The nice guys never even make it to the history books. When the Indians, let the Indians speak to us as fellow Americans, which they are, that's quoted in the editorial. And then I say, when they are doing just that, let's listen for a change and really redress certain grievances. Mm.
At the site, I'm just wondering, what is the relationship of AIM to the observers at this point? And what, is that going to be a continuing sort of thing, do you think, or should it?
I don't know. The relationship of AIM to the observers has been a very positive one. I'll mention this as a friend out there and we got in long discussions, but you're out on observer posts for 18 or 20 hours. There's not much else to do. A lot of the Indians are quite well educated in at least Indian history areas, and have a great respect for William Penn and his friends, because it's about the only treaty they know of that wasn't broken. I had to tell them, well, there were a few minor things like the walk-in purchase, which, this one guy hadn't heard of.
Neither Penn nor the Quakers.
What?
The Penn sons, but not William.
Yeah, right. I mean, I explained that, but I thought it only fair that he was sort of raising us a little bit too high. So, but I had a talk with Stan, the security chief, and I said, I'll be working out here for a while. And I told him what I was doing. I said, just so you know where I'm coming from. I explained that, I had a commitment to nonviolence and dealing with things, and that I was a friend, and that, I wasn't trying to impose this on him or to say, I'm right and you're wrong or anything. But, it was just an honest exchange of where we were. I said, that's fine. We respect you for it. One of the criticisms made of Crazy Horse was that he would not tell young men to fight. That in the Indian tradition, it's a man's choice whether he fights or not, and that they respect either viewpoint. He said, "We like what you're doing. You're doing a good thing. Don't feel at all defensive, or that you're in disagreement with what you're doing is right. That our ancestors put our guns down here 83 years ago, and we haven't forgotten that, so we aren't going to put ours down." And it was just a very honest exchange of relationship.
It's interesting to see the really editorial reaction. I appreciate the bulletin that I printed some time ago, a very bigoted, ignorant expression of views in a letter. And they featured it for some reason, and I think it was because they wanted to get a lot of rebuttal. And they featured a big, large picture of Sitting Bull. And about 3 days later, the whole editorial page was covered, was plastered with terrifically good rebuttals on this letter. I think the paper possibly purposely did this. Big response. It was an avalanche of good letters putting this fellow in his place.
Well, I noticed especially that one about they were putting the NCC people out as because they were aiding and abetting the enemy. I said, boy, that quote-unquote enemy, who's the enemy?
The news accounts have really been rather friendly, and in several cases the emissaries that came out said that they had been well-treated and there had been a friendly atmosphere, and some of the pictures show very calm and sympathetic scene. So I think we were not in too bad shape with regard to the press coverage.
When the ABC sound man was down in Pine Ridge one day, I was sort of wandering around to find out what I could find out. And I just went over, I'd seen him before in Washington on occasion, on one occasion. He didn't remember me. But anyway, I was just, asking if he had been in. And, at one point, I didn't go into my role work, but I had already been in the wounded knee a bit by that time. And I said, I must say, I've got a certain respect for the press folks, being in there. And I was mean because if a firefight started, they were going to be right in the middle of it. He thought I meant because they ought to be afraid of the Indians. And he said, no, wait a minute. He said, those AIM people have really been nice to us. You don't have anything to fear. You can go in there and they'll treat you very well. So I know I was referring to, getting attacked by the FBI. He said, then he realized, and I explained what I was doing there. But, he was really telling.
He thought you read the history books and the things massacred people.
What was the makeup of the observers there? And there were a number of friends there, of course.
It's a very interesting circle of people. There were two people from the Direct Friends Service Committee in Des Moines, Midge Slater, who I think is their peace secretary, is that correct?
Yeah.
And Tom Leffler, who works in that office, they spent 3-4 days. Tom was there most of the week.